On RN, welcome to Encounter. This week, the world of faith and medicine. I'm Gary Bryson. The human body is highly contested space, and disputes over how best to heal it have a long history. In Australia, there's a push by the medical mainstream to shore up the boundaries around who practices medicine and how, and to have such practices as naturopathy, acupuncture, and herbal medicine removed from university faculties. But despite the controversy, complementary and alternative medicines known as CAM are becoming increasingly popular. Today's program explores the history of ideas behind alternative medicine, a history that's got a lot to do with religion and with the philosophy of the human body. And it takes a look at contemporary notions of faith and health as practiced within two Christian denominations. The program's produced by Mark Franklin.
Health is some set of states that people aspire towards. So health very often in CAM has a sense of transcendence about it.
Well, a source of health to me comes from God. God made me healthy and well, and he keeps me healthy and well. That's where I attribute the source of my good health to.
Look, the interesting thing is there's no doubt that we can manipulate man's mind, and we can manipulate it biochemically. But there is an element to man which I think is more attuned with who man is, actually.
I'm at the complementary health clinic where Sari Lamsa comes for treatment. As traffic rumbles past the window, her holistic health practitioner, Dr. Nick Bassel, asks a series of questions about the pain she's experiencing.
So it's kind of a discomfort sitting in your chest deep inside. It's got weight. Just interested if it feels like it has a different temperature to the rest of you.
It feels like it changes.
Yeah.
It's cold and hot and cold.
Cold and hot and cold, yeah. Does it feel to you like when that feeling is here with you, that it has an emotional quality to it?
Mm.
Yeah, what would you say?
Scared.
Yeah, there's a scared feeling that comes with it. Okay. So we're getting to find out a bit more information, and I'm wondering if we could just find out a little bit more that might be useful.
I had problems with my neck. I was working with computer, sitting down all day, but I think there are other reasons as well. It really limited my life in many ways. I started to get headaches. I had to kind of start to organize my life a little bit around my neck being a problem. It lasted a very, very long time, close to 20 years before I started seeing Nick.
Emotions are experienced as physical sensations in the body. For example, people are commonly thinking in terms of butterflies in the stomach. That's an emotion. Getting your bowels in a knot, that's an emotion. Feeling broken-hearted or feeling like the wind is out of their sails as far as being hurt in the chest, that's an emotion. These are all emotions. We just don't call them that, but we physicalize them. And whenever someone connects a physical sensation to what's going on in their outside world, they begin to make links that are much more useful than thinking, oh, there's something wrong with my neck. You can begin to think, gee, my neck tells me when I'm feeling scared, or when I'm thinking about what could happen tomorrow that I'm feeling is really threatening to me, my tummy responds by tightening up. So if you can begin to turn it around from there's something wrong with me to there's a lot of information here, you immediately begin to change your approach.
I do believe that we are very complex beings, that we are much more than our physical parts. I do believe that our bodies contain memories and history and feelings, and that we are in a complex place, and I think treating anything would be kind of superficial if you don't take that complexity into account.
There's no doubt that the emphasis on spirituality in alternative medicine is one of its
very important attractions. And of course, in the history of the different forms of alternative medicine, spirituality and religion has played an important role.
Michael Goldstein is Professor of Public Health and Sociology at the University of California, Los Angeles. He has written extensively about complementary and alternative medicine, or CAM, practices such as Chinese herbal medicine, acupuncture, chiropractic, naturopathy, and the traditional Indian practice of Ayurveda. He says all these health philosophies have one or two things in common.
The belief in some sort of a higher power would be one thing, and that the higher power or some form of it can actually enter the body in some way, and that is a force that can be utilized by the person to either heal themselves or to combine with some other element, some type of medicine or some other type of therapeutic intervention to increase its power in some way. Of course, the language has been replaced and has been de-religified, if you will. And sometimes the notion of religion has been replaced with spirituality or with broad terms relating to nature. But it's still the underlying notion is larger forces that are not necessarily demonstrable by in terms of Western science are out there, and that they can enter the individual in some way to bring them benefit.
I see ourselves as energy, that our energy is not only within our body, but our energy field actually expands beyond our body, and that our energy fields are connected with other people's energy fields, and that the whole universe is in a way connected at energetic level.
You know, it gets to notions of vitalism, and it gets to notions of balance, which, of course, are very important in the Buddhist tradition, very important in the Ayurvedic tradition, where you have different body types and personality types coexisting within individuals, and the question is to balance them and to have them reach some sort of equilibrium. Basically, these are both what you would call vitalistic traditions. By vitalism, I mean that at their root, both of these traditions believe that there is some sort of a life force that suffuses the body and has certain pathways that it runs through the body. When those pathways are blocked or impeded in some way, that's when symptoms occur. That's when disease occurs.
Notions of vitalism and balance were also central to medical thinking throughout Europe in the pre-modern period. Ideas about the physical body were based on humoral theory, a system conceived by the Greek physicians Galen and Hippocrates.
They're concerned with what they call the constitution or the complexion of the body. And that means, what's the balance in the body between the four humours, as they call them, the four kinds of substances that make up the body? There's the sanguine humour, which is basically the blood. There's what they call yellow bile, choler, black bile, melancholy, and phlegm. They think that these substances in various combinations make up the body, but they also determine the person's temperament. If you have a kind of slight imbalance towards blood, for instance, you will be cheerful and energetic and robust. If you have an imbalance towards black choler, melancholy, you'll be kind of fearful, anxious, distressed, all these kinds of things.
Philippa Madden is Winthrop Professor of Medieval History at the University of Western Australia. She says medieval people were entirely comfortable with the notion that the body contained both a physical and a spiritual dimension.
There's a strong tradition within medieval thinking that illness may be imposed either on an individual or on a people because of their sin, to bring them to repentance. And because of that, there's a theory that illness of the body may actually be good for the soul. It may kind of bring the soul to repentance and help you to get back on the right path. It can also work, as I say, in terms of kind of whole communities. So when the Black Death, for instance, first broke out in Europe and it arrived in England, one of the first actions of the Bishop of Winchester to try to control it or to manage it in some way was to hold public processions of repentance. So clearly his idea was the whole community was falling under God's punishment because they had sinned or because they were not in a right relationship to God. And the only way to restore that relationship was to make that community do communal penance.
To what extent were prayer and repentance by the sick seen as a path towards healing?
Absolutely essential. Many hospitals in the late Middle Ages, and this is all over Europe, in England, in Italy, will not take in a sick person unless they have formally gone to confession, you know, confessed their sins and been given absolution. And it's not because they're kind of, I don't know, they're trying to be ideologically Christian. It's because though they think that there are medical remedies that can be applied to the illness, they think the remedies really won't work unless you can get the person back into a proper stage of repentance. Without that, nothing else will work as well, so you might as well not even try.
Of course, there are still many people who do think that illnesses are a response to sin or transgression in some way. And even many people who don't admit to that still have some of those feelings within them, even if they don't speak openly about it. On the other hand, in some ways, sins like sloth have been transformed into statements about exercise, for example. And so some of those old ideas remain with us. And then when we have problems like obesity or diabetes or cardiovascular problems, it's relatively easy for people to make a connection in their minds between some of these old sins and behaviors that they have or have not engaged in. Gluttony, for example, is another one that is very much in the news today with all the emphasis about obesity. So I think some of those old ways of thinking are far from gone in society, and there's definitely been a relabeling of that.
To what extent, then, do CAM practitioners and other doctors as well act almost as teachers or moral guides for how a person should live?
Well, certainly as teachers, the role of the healer in CAM is often to educate people about their individual qualities that maybe have brought upon the illness or made it worse, and then, most importantly, to assist them in taking the actions they need to take to modify the situation. So it's really much more of being in the role of a guide or a teacher, yes.
There's a kind of genre in the Middle Ages called a dietary, which is basically how to live a healthy life. And from our point of view, or from a modern point of view, it can look kind of bewilderingly mixed because it has a whole lot of really sensible advice. You know, make sure you kind of get enough sleep, don't stress yourself out, don't get over cold, don't sit around in wet clothes in a cold wind, eat moderately, eat a good varied diet, all these kinds of things that we would now say, yep, excellent advice. But every description of the daily regime of a good and healthy person will make sure to mention that they make time for prayers, to go to Mass, to say confession, all these kinds of things. It's clearly to them unimaginable that a healthy lifestyle could exist without that mingling of the physical and the spiritual well-being.
Let's talk for a moment about souls, because the concept of a soul was central to medieval beliefs about the body and how it worked. Professor Philippa Madden again.
It's just fascinating because it's quite a kind of difficult concept to grasp, and yet medieval thinkers and even sort of not very well educated people seem to have grasped the idea that each human is fundamentally and essentially composed of what sounds like a kind of oxymoron of the soul and the body. So the soul, they think the soul and the body are kind of just radically different entities. You know, the soul is entirely spiritual, the body is physical. The soul has reason and intellect, the body has none. The soul is invisible, the body obviously is visible. The soul is immortal, the body dies and rots. You know, they're like two absolutely opposite substances. And yet, they say, they are just inextricably conjoined. Each soul with each body is just knitted together so strongly that you cannot part them.
Was the soul conceived as the animating, life-giving part of a person?
Absolutely, absolutely. The body cannot move, it cannot think, it cannot be an individual without the soul.
Would you describe this as a vitalist concept?
In a way it is, yes. It's even vitalist in the sense that medical theorists have a very physical theory of how the soul actually animates the body, and they identify what they would call the venous channels, some of the veins and some of the lymph system going from the head into the body, as the means by which the soul animates the body. They say the soul and the body together kind of create vital spirits, pneuma, they call it breath, which can then be distributed through the body through these channels. We would now, I presume, call them nerves or veins or whatever. They call them the venous system, which then makes the body work, makes it kind of move, think, see, observe, speak, all the rest of it.
Gradually, notions of supernaturalism, providence, God interfering regularly in people's lives, all of that kind of thing. It's still around in the 17th century, but certainly the work of people like Harvey and Descartes are pushing things because they're implicitly, anyway, taking out elements of the supernatural, of the spiritual, even though they might not actually say that up front because that's a bit dangerous to say it.
Dr. Susan Hardy teaches the history and philosophy of medicine at the University of New South Wales. William Harvey was a physician whose book De Motu Cordis, on the motion of the heart and blood, revolutionised thinking about how the body worked.
Harvey's work had been done with vivisection on animals, so he was continuing the Paduan idea of the notion that the blood circulates around the body, pumped by the heart. So here you've got the mechanistic idea of a heart as a pump. It pumps the blood round the body, as opposed to Galenic ideas, which were much more a kind of washing backwards and forwards. So here's a completely different notion of how the body actually works. So if you do that, if you do the experiments to show how it happens, how the heart slows down, how the different organs are fed by the blood, it's almost as if you've kind of displaced a soul. Because where is the soul actually residing in the body? How can it be a material soul if you can't actually pinpoint it? Because by now the point of anatomy is to describe minutely different parts of the body. I mean, Harvey's even down to the capillaries in the body. But where's the soul? Nobody's found it.
Most medieval thinkers are very wary of complete dualism because that's heresy. That's the Manichaean heresy.
The heresy of dualism is the idea that the soul and body are in some way separate, that they can act independently of one another. And that's where the 17th century French philosopher René Descartes comes in.
His famous saying, of course, is, I think, therefore I am. He was trying to get down to complete basics here about how do you think. So he's kind of trying to get down to what you might call first principles of what's going on.
Because he talked about the body in quite a mechanistic way, didn't he?
Yes, this was the period when there were machines. So you could use machines as a metaphor. A machine works regularly. It always works in exactly the same way. When it breaks down, you can fix it. So you could apply this as a metaphor to the body. The body, because of the anatomy that had been done recently. You could see the body as a collection of parts, like a machine, the cogs, the wheels, etc., etc. They all worked beautifully when they worked. When one bit of it perhaps stopped working, you just fixed that. There was no other element to it. There was no spiritual element or anything like that to it. It just worked or it didn't. But then you've got to think, okay, we've got this mechanistic body, but it's not really like a machine, because machines don't think. They don't have emotions. They don't have a spiritual element to them. So then, presumably, thinks Descartes, second guessing, how do I account for this element of human beings? So I guess that's where he had to come in with the body-mind. It was quite a revolutionary thing that he was saying about a separation here.
Dr. Susan Hardy. You're listening to Encounter on RN, and we're discussing how beliefs about the body affect people's ideas about healthcare. The word holism is closely associated with complementary and alternative medicine, or CAM, as it's often called. Professor Michael Goldstein from the University of California, Los Angeles, explains why.
Holism was a reaction to the dualism, which was the dominant philosophical base of Western medicine, dualism meaning the separation of the mind and the body, where in CAM approaches, the mind and the body and the spirit, or the soul as you termed it, are seen as interpenetrating each other in many, you know, extremely complicated ways.
What does that lead to when you talk about a person in a holistic way compared to in a dualistic way? What's the impact of that?
Well, the practical impact is that you wind up looking at the causes of a particular problem, the causes of a symptom or the causes of illness, through a very individualistic lens, because if the symptom is understood as by necessity being a combination of the mind and the body and the spirit, and those three dimensions are involved, even though you and I have the identical symptom, our understanding of how it arose is going to be different because our mentalities, our psychologies, our spirituality is different. So, for example, this is a trivial example, but let's say we each break out in hives and the dermatologist speaks to us about it and we say, yes, we know whenever we're under stress, this problem is likely to have an outbreak or to be exacerbated in some way. And so we would seem to have that in common. But then, lo and behold, it turns out that it's very different things that make us feel that we are under stress. In one case, one of us might feel very stressed if we have to talk to a large group of people, where the other person feels, well, just the opposite. I'm very comfortable talking to large groups of people, but in intimate settings, I find it very, very stressful. And that's when I break out in hives. So here we start with the same symptom, the same supposedly identical physical manifestation of a problem. But once we introduce a holistic perspective, we see that the roots of the problem are somewhat different, and therefore the alleviation of the problem is going to be different.
It was in Paris, just after the French Revolution, that Western medicine took a very different direction from holism.
Paris medicine was the cutting edge, revolutionary kind of medicine that was being done in Paris in the beginning of the 19th century, in the unlikely period, in fact, of the French Revolution, or at least the end part of the French Revolution, when the large hospitals in Paris and rest of France had large and huge numbers of patients in them who were, under the revolution notion of rationality, were organized into wards where they were classified by their symptoms. The impact was a change in diagnosis of the body, and in doing that, it meant that doctors were able to diagnose not simply from the whole body, which has always been the case up until the early 19th century, but now from bits of the body. So it makes the whole process of diagnosis much more impersonal. So you don't need to talk to the person, whoever the patient is. You don't even need their whole body there. Now in Paris medicine, where they're doing the dissection down to tissue level in the body, all you need is a bit of tissue and you can do your diagnosis from that.
How has that developed into the modern era?
Well, in some ways, very helpfully for patients, because it's certainly much improved the diagnosis, and therefore with an improvement in diagnosis, you've also got a chance of cure. So it's looking pretty good, but there's also the other side to it that says that right from the days of Paris medicine, when you started cutting people up and then diagnosing them after they were dead from the tissues, or indeed even taking tissues from live patients, it's become much more impersonal. So now, instead of having to talk to a patient for a fairly long time to find out what's the matter with them, to actually touch them, to have a hands-on kind of experience, perhaps modern medicines evolve much more into a kind of quick fix kind of medicine, which in some cases I think most of us probably wouldn't want to get rid of, because if you have something simple and straightforward, of course, nobody wants to be sick and dying of that. On the other hand, there is another element to human beings that want a bit more of a personal approach, that feels you need to be considered as a human being, as a whole human being, rather than simply the bit of you that happens to be sick.
What is a man? Brain? Heart? Blood? Bones? The material structure? If the real man is in the material body, then you take away a portion of the man when you amputate a limb. Man is not material. He is spiritual. Mortal belief is all that enables a drug to cure mortal ailments. Anatomy admits that mind is somewhere in man, though out of sight. Then, if an individual is sick, why treat the body alone and administer a dose of despair to the mind? We should understand that the cause of disease obtains in the human mind, and its cure comes from the immortal divine mind.
That's from the writings of Mary Baker Eddy. She lived in America in the 1800s, and her book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, gave rise to a very metaphysical offshoot of Christianity, known as Christian Science.
Mary Baker Eddy believed that we could heal as Jesus did if we understood the basis from which he was doing that healing work, and that was from a spiritual basis. He wasn't prescribing drugs. Jesus never used drugs. He never told people to swallow anything or take anything or run a mile or whatever. He approached it from a purely spiritual basis, and that was, he knew that a perfect God had created men and women in his image and likeness. So to me, there was a clear metaphysical basis for his healing work. And that's what Mary Baker Eddy drew on when she was putting her ideas down in Science and Health.
Beverly Goldsmith is a Christian Science practitioner and teacher. She doesn't use conventional medicine. Instead, she practices healing through prayer and mental attitude in accordance with the teachings of Mary Baker Eddy.
Well, a source of health to me comes from God. God made me healthy and well, and he keeps me healthy and well. That's where I attribute the source of my good health to, not to something I eat or something I drink. That's not where my source of health comes from. Because health is spiritually mental. It starts with what we think. So I've learnt to think higher than that, to think of it from a metaphysical standpoint, that health is a spiritually mental quality which I express and possess as God's image and likeness.
What then is illness? And what is the source of illness?
Well, illness has, to me, its origin in thought. It often arises from mental association. For example, in winter, supermarkets and advertisers put all sorts of images of illness into thinking. You know, you watch the advertisements on TV with people coughing and spluttering, so that's being presented to our thought. You also hear reports of a particular sickness going around, and then you start believing that you're likely to catch it. And this expectation, together with the mental image of sickness, is subsequently manifested on the body.
Is there a relationship between illness and sin?
There can be. There can be. I've found in my experience, though, that illnesses that I have suffered from over the years tend to be, as I mentioned earlier, from association or something that's made a deep mental impression on my thinking.
Would you say that people are responsible for their own illness and health by virtue of their mental state or their relationship to God?
Yes, you can put it like that, very much so, because what we think, as I said earlier, we live in our thinking. And what we do and what we say is determined by what we think first.
What are the implications then, if a person is responsible for their own state of illness and health, on people who contract terrible illnesses?
It's a scary thought to think that what one thinks determines what one experiences. That can be scary. But for me, it was also very empowering, because I realised I could take charge of my own health and well-being, that I could be responsible for that and learn to experience health and wellness on a consistent level.
Essentially, though, say a child who contracts a terminal illness, they're responsible for that, for their own illness.
No, a child wouldn't be, because, well, it depends what age you're talking about, but a young child wouldn't be responsible because they're not in charge of their own thoughts early on.
Well, an adult then?
Well, sometimes a parent's fear can be manifested, and that's what needs to be taken into account with healing. So the parent doesn't feel that great fear in childbirth or having had a child, or be fearful of their exposure to illness as they grow up. That's a fear that has to be conquered and can be.
Do you mean that the parent's fear can manifest in the child?
It can in certain instances if it's a very great fear. I've seen that happen.
As illness?
Yeah, I've seen that happen.
Let's hear from another American woman who lived at the same time as Mary Baker Eddy.
Since the mind and the soul find expression through the body, both mental and spiritual vigour are in great degree dependent upon physical strength and activity. Whatever promotes physical health promotes the development of a strong mind and a well-balanced character.
Those are the words of Ellen G. White. Like Mary Baker Eddy, she also founded a Christian tradition that has particular beliefs about the body and how to look after it, although it takes a rather different approach. For Seventh-day Adventists, the delivery of healthcare is part of the Christian mission, and they have a strong history of involvement with medicine and nutrition.
Adventists are particularly interested not only in acute care, but particularly in being able to provide an opportunity and an empowerment for people to learn and to live well, so that they actually will have a healthier existence. Now, part of that, of course, relates to their physical wellness, and that is probably the main thing that that the community would understand Adventists to provide.
Dr. Ross Grant is a Seventh-day Adventist. He's also a neuropharmacologist. That's someone who studies how chemicals affect the brain. He's the director of the Australasian Research Institute at the San Hospital in Sydney. It's one of the many hospitals around the world that is owned by the Adventist Church.
Okay, Mark, this is our research lab. The sorts of things we do here are testing particularly some of the small biochemical changes that might happen as a result of some of our lifestyle effects.
And what's that humming noise over there?
That's the GC mass spec, or gas chromatography mass spectrometry instrument.
What does it do?
Well, what this enables us to do is detect very tiny amounts of very small molecules that we're looking for, and we're able to identify them with extreme accuracy.
What else do we have in the lab here?
We have what's called spectrophotometry and spectrofluorimetry.
That one looks like a fax machine, but I've no idea where you'd put the paper.
That's right.
Great, well, thank you for showing me around the lab. Let's move to somewhere a little quieter.
Sounds good.
Why is the body's health, physical health, of particular importance to Adventists?
In order to respond to God and have the best connection with God, man needs to be able to perceive God, which is certainly influenced by the health of the body to a large extent. So I think that's the first thing. In order for us to have the best opportunity to have our best relationship and clearest understanding of God, we need to be healthy, because God interacts with us through our bodies, particularly through our minds.
So a healthy body contributes to a healthy spiritual relationship with God. Does it work the other way around? Does a healthy spiritual relationship with God contribute to a healthy body?
Yeah, look, there is, and we would say yes to that too. And in fact, a correct relationship with God provides the best, if you like, psychological framework and mental framework ultimately to build a healthy body. But it does work both ways. Certainly a lot of data has looked at the influence of religion, particularly on health of the body.
Pure air, sunlight, abstemiousness, rest, exercise, proper diet, the use of water, trust in divine power. These are the true remedies. Every person should have a knowledge of nature's remedial agencies and how to apply them.
Those are Ellen White's eight rules of health, as Ross Grant explains.
Yeah, what underpins essentially her writings on health, which are relatively extensive, can be summed up in the acronym New Start. So N standing for nutrition, and that was essentially a sort of a vegetarian, certainly vegetable-rich diet. Then there was exercise, doing sort of regular exercise. The use of water, and that was internal and external, so making sure you had enough hydration, but also using it for bathing and various things. Sunlight, which again was a surprising thing to be brought up at the time, saying that man needed adequate sunlight, and she was particularly concerned about people who were locked away as they were sick inside, to actually get them outside and have a little bit of sunlight on them. She then talked about temperance, and she was certainly right on the ball in relation to alcohol. But she also included things like tea and coffee, so the caffeinated beverages within there. She talked about air, so the need for fresh air and the need for regular rest. And then the final one is trust in God, so essentially that trust in divine power.
While Adventists embrace modern-day healthcare, Christian Scientists have their own style of care.
A Christian Science nurse is someone who will maybe be called in to help somebody bathe and dress and to provide nourishing meals for that individual and to support their reliance on Christian Science prayer. That's what the nurse does.
And what's the relationship between nurse and patient? Is the nurse paid?
A Christian Science nurse receives a remuneration that's worked out between the patient and the nurse, yes?
There's some scepticism towards Christian Science, and particularly because Christian Scientists have even appeared in court because medical treatment was not provided to followers. I was just wondering if you could respond to the idea that Christian Scientists are being somehow remiss in not seeking conventional medical treatment.
Well, once again, I can't speak for everybody. I can only speak based on my own personal experience. Christian Scientists are free to seek medical attention whenever they want to. There's nothing that stops them from doing that. For me and my own personal life, because I've had 50 years of perfectly acceptable treatment for any illness that I've had along the way, that wouldn't be my first choice to go to a doctor. Why would it be? My first choice would be to employ Christian Science for healing, If it didn't work, then I'd have to try something else. But since I've never been in that position, I can't tell you what I would do. But in answer to your question, no, I think Christian Scientists practice their health care and healing in a very practical, logical way. And that's, for most of us, what we would do first. And then if it wasn't successful or didn't meet our needs, then we'd have to consider what else there was available.
You're on RN, this is Encounter, and we're discussing how beliefs about the body affect people's ideas about healthcare. The introduction of effective antibiotics and painkillers was one of the great triumphs of Western medicine. The success of these miracle drugs gave people tremendous faith. Medical historian Dr. Susan Hardy says that, for a while at least, it seemed medical science would be able to provide all the health solutions people needed.
Well, certainly the penicillin story, which is told almost like the story of the dead coming back to life, this really did change things, because for the first time with penicillin, you've got a broad-spectrum antibiotic which can address infections which up until the 1930s were fatal. You could get a small scratch on your hand, the wrong bacteria comes along, infects your bloodstream, and in a very short time, you're dead. So the notion that you could be cured from this just instantly, almost, was really quite amazing. And it almost psychologically kind of tipped over into other areas. Well, if you can do it instantly in this area, why is it not going to be possible to do it instantly in other areas? So I think there was tremendous optimism that this is just the start. And from now on, we'll be able to cure just about anything. Unfortunately, of course, didn't quite turn out to be like that.
It's only 70 years since penicillin was first used to cure a dying patient. And medical science has discovered many more life-saving innovations since then. So why are patients looking for complementary health options? Professor Michael Goldstein.
I think the basic reason is that in contemporary industrial societies, the major health problems are chronic illnesses. And conventional medicine, in some ways, is ill-equipped to respond to chronic conditions compared to, let's say, the way it was able to respond to trauma or the way it was able to respond to acute, particularly infectious problems. There are very practical matters of time. It seems almost every year the length of time for medical visits becomes briefer and briefer. And to deal with the kinds of things we've been talking about here requires a good deal of time. There's a focus on procedures. Practitioners are reimbursed for procedures. They're not reimbursed for talking to people. And then in terms of spirituality or religion, there are all kinds of taboos in conventional medicine about talking about these things openly in the doctor-patient encounter. First of all, very frequently, doctors and patients are coming from very different spiritual or religious backgrounds, and it would seem to be inappropriate if doctors were to impose their views or to even sometimes question patients about their views. So the situation is fraught with many, many elements that really minimize the ability to provide the kinds of care and the guiding and the teaching that people with chronic conditions often want very badly.
Let's hear again from Professor Philippa Madden about medieval ideas.
When you read writers like Aquinas talking about how passions arise in the soul, which is really what they mean by how emotions arise in the mind, and its effect on the body, they sound sometimes almost exactly like the most recent work of cognitive psychologists talking about how emotions are involved and the bodily reactions that are involved with emotions and the relationship between cognition and physical reaction. Sometimes they sound almost the same, except that the cognitive psychologists have done it through kind of modern means of experiment, and Thomas Aquinas just worked it out. How could it work?
Given the emergence in recent years of what might be called mind-body medicine, do you get the sense that ideas about the body are now coming around full circle?
In some ways, I think they are, yes. I think they're doing so without the whole kind of Christian substructure that sustained that medieval thought. But it's interesting to me, as I say, to see how often medieval theory on how the mind works or how memory works or whatever it might be and modern cognitive psychology come to maybe not the same conclusions but very similar ones. I find it fascinating, and I find it, I suppose, greatly to the credit of medieval thinkers that without many of the experimental possibilities that we now have, they nevertheless managed to theorise so kind of usefully many of the things that go on between our minds and bodies.
So what do we consider health to mean? Is it simply being free of illness and injury? Or is there more to it than that?
Well, let me begin by saying what health is for most people as they interact in the contemporary medical care system. I think in that, health is a residual quality.
Professor Michael Goldstein from UCLA.
By that I mean you go to the doctor, the doctor asks you a bunch of questions, and you say no to the questions, and then the doctor administers some tests, some blood tests, some x-rays, whatever, and those tests come back negative, and everything is negative, and the doctor says you're healthy. In other words, health is what's left over when illnesses and symptoms have been found not to exist. So that's the definition, the working practical definition of health that I think pervades the Western mentality about healthcare. I think the definition of health in CAM is quite different. It's a positive definition. Health is some set of states that people aspire towards. It could be in terms of their functioning, their ability to function. Everybody functions at a certain level, but everyone can function better. So health very often in CAM has a sense of transcendence about it. You're at a certain place now, wherever you are, you can be better. You can have these goals.
Medical science often tries to explain people by looking at the physical workings of their bodies and brains. As a neuropharmacologist, Dr. Ross Grant is keenly aware of this, but he believes there's one element, at least, that lies beyond the sight of microscopes.
Look, the interesting thing is there's no doubt that we can manipulate man's mind, and we can manipulate it biochemically. We've been doing it by ourselves for years, so we take a bit of alcohol. We become, you know, it's a little bit of Dutch courage. But there is an element to man which I think is more attuned with who man is, actually, particularly with his ability to have free choice and free will. That's the part that interacts with God. This is the part that God ultimately is concerned with. And maintaining that intact creates that connection with God, or enables that connection with God, which we need to be very judicious about, not only about preserving, but potentially improving as well.
If a human person is more than just their physical body, what impact does the non-physical parts, the spiritual parts of a person, have on their health and well-being?
I think for most people, there is an inherent interest, if not desire, in the spiritual. We know that within the context of human health, we have mind and we have body and the connections through emotions, and we have them both influencing each other. The element to the spiritual, which I think is a growing awareness for most people, that spiritual connection is something that provides context. And the fact that God is particularly interested in them in a very altruistic or completely selfless way. So the impact of health, of having a connection with the spiritual, is, if nothing else, and probably in its most simplistic sense, it will reduce his anxiety about so many things, because the world, the context in which he lives, now has taken on some form. And if nothing else, that would provide for man an improvement in terms of his overall health.
So back to Sari Lumsa and to the clinic where Dr. Nick Bassel is treating her neck pain. His method of treatment is simply to ask Sari a series of questions, designed to help her explore her pain and any emotional connections it might have.
And when you notice it, what kinds of things do you say to yourself about it?
I can't talk, I can't breathe.
Yeah.
I can't do whatever I need to do.
What you want to do. Yeah. So when the feeling is with you, it's like it's a problem. It's getting in the way of something that you want to do. It's uncomfortable. Yeah, it's understandably. Okay. So I'm wondering if we could just try something else that might be useful. Wondering if you could just turn around and inside yourself say hello to this experience. And let's get to know. I see you nodding your head. Yeah, and I know you. So inside yourself, you're kind of turning around and saying hello. And I'm wondering if you could tell me what happens if you say to it, "You're welcome." You're welcome to be here. What happens as you do that?
It likes it.
Something inside likes that?
Yeah. It likes it.
Yeah. You have a little surprised look on your face, huh?
It kind of softens.
Yeah.
It's not as heavy.
Not so tight. Yeah.
I think there are places where you kind of go. Things are going well in your life. You kind of flow with life. And I feel that those are the moments where you somehow magically are connected with everything in life, so that you know what to do and you kind of not struggling against it. You somehow... It's difficult to explain, but I think it's kind of... You feel connected. You somehow feel like the universe is looking after you, or... that some higher power is even looking after you, so that you feel safe and you feel that you're in the right place and you're doing the right things.
On RN, you've been listening to Encounter. Guests this week were Sari Lumsa, Dr. Nick Bassel, Professor Philippa Madden, Professor Michael Goldstein, Dr. Susan Hardy, Dr. Ross Grant, and Beverly Goldsmith. Many thanks to all of them, and thanks also to Jenny Parsonage for studio production.
And that encounter with faith and medicine was produced and presented by Mark Franklin. On Encounter next week, David Busch joins a gathering of philosophers and theologians, historians and writers, believers and non-believers, who consider what it means to be religious, and what role the voice of faith may legitimately have in the conversations of citizens in a modern democracy. That's Encounter next Saturday, after the news at 5. Hope you can join us then.
It was the Church of George Washington, Franklin Roosevelt, and George Bush Sr., the church with more Supreme Court judges than any other US denomination, are the once dominant Episcopalians on the verge of collapse. Bishops are quitting over gay marriage, transgender priests, and the fear that many Episcopal clergy don't believe in God. the story of decline and fall on the Religion and Ethics Report. And you can download or stream this program from the RN website.